I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include the French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. He is the author of 4 cookbooks, including the French Laundry Cookbook. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
It took you quite a few years before you bought the French Laundry and your career really took off. You held various cooking positions in Florida, Rhode Island, Catskill in upstate New York. You apprenticed in France. You then went from your first restaurant called Raquel in New York City to another restaurant in Los Angeles. And finally, you landed in Yountville in the Napa Valley. How did you find the French Laundry?
I was in Los Angeles at the time. I was dating a woman who was a wine broker in Los Angeles. Of course, many of her wineries were in Napa Valley. So I would travel with her to Napa Valley probably twice a month. And at that time, there was a chef, a colleague, friend from New York City, Jonathan Waxman, who was opening his first restaurant outside of New York in California called Table 29. And during construction, I stopped by to see him one day on one of my trips. He knew I wasn't working. He said, Thomas, there's this restaurant in Yountville called the French Laundry, and I know it's for sale, and I think it'd be perfect for you. And so that was really the catalyst that started the process. And I went to Yountville. I walked on the property of the French Laundry and just emotionally resonated with me. I felt like this was the place.
By the way, this girlfriend, the wine broker, is this the woman whom you started an olive oil company with called Evo in 1992?
Exactly. Yeah, Diane Harder. Exactly. Mm. Diane and I started an olive oil company called Evo. It was a time when I wasn't working and I was trying to find other avenues from a culinary point of view where I could have an impact.
There's a quote in the French Laundry Cookbook which resonated with me. When you first discovered the French Laundry, you said, I gave the French Laundry a new life, and it gave me a new life. And that implies a level of sadness prior to the French Laundry. Was there sadness in your life or restlessness prior to that?
Well, there was certainly a great sense of uncertainty in my life. New York, when I was in New York at Raquel, you know, this city was my home. It was the center of the universe. I never thought I would ever leave New York City. I was emotionally and physically committed to Raquel. And of course, when that failed, I was set adrift, didn't really know what to do. I spent a year in New York trying to find some connection to something, really didn't, and ended up in L.A. I went out there to be the chef of Checkers Hotel. A great hotel. We got great exposure. It was a great success. But ultimately, that was a failure for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was set adrift again in L.A., and I didn't really know what I was going to do. Was I destined to be a chef? Was I cut out to be a chef? As much as I love cooking, as much as I love the fact of nurturing people through food. So the French Laundry was kind of my last effort. Mm-hmm. If that didn't work, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Why do you think Raquel didn't work out?
There's a number of different things. Certainly, you know, at that time in New York, which was the mid-80s, I mean, it was just booming. Americans were learning about French cuisine, about fine dining, and certainly Raquel was a version of that at that moment. Raquel was downtown in a new area, Hudson Square. My partner, Serge Raoul, who owns Raoul's, certainly had great experience in New York and certainly great experience downtown. I had just come back from France, learning about French food, living there, learning really in the detail of French food. And it was a great success for the first 4 years. I mean, the restaurant was 6 years old by the time we closed it. And then, of course, the area didn't develop as that was predicted to develop. We had certainly the stock market downturn. But I think one of the big reasons is I really didn't understand how to run a restaurant. And from that moment on, I knew that if I was going to have another restaurant, if I was going to be lucky enough to have another restaurant in my life, I needed to have individuals involved in that restaurant that knew more than I did about finance, knew more than I did about running a dining room. I was a chef, you know, and a lot of chefs think they can do everything. I realized at that moment at Raquel, at great expense, personal expense, financial expense, that I didn't know everything I needed to know.
I've heard you say that one of the appeals to cooking is the immediate gratification that you get. But looking at your history, it seems like your life has been more of one of a patient gardener. a gardener who has to tolerate the erratic nature of the weather and other components out of one's control. What is your temperament?
It's interesting when you say patience. I learned patience relatively later in life, and a big part of that came to me when I was trying to put together the financial structure for the French Laundry and buying the French Laundry. I would call my attorney every day and ask him if there was any news. And finally, one day he said, "Thomas, listen, I'll call you when there's news." And I had to keep myself busy, and I had to learn to be patient. And then, of course, persistence. I mean, I sit here today as a true example of somebody who was persistent.
You talk about patience in the kitchen, and in your cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, you talk about being mindful about cutting an artichoke. What are some other examples of your being mindful of the mundane in the kitchen?
Cooking is repetition, and I think that as cooks, you have to be comfortable with knowing that you're going to be doing the same thing your entire career. And of course, that's going to change and evolve, but at the basis of what you're doing, you're cooking, whether it's sautéing or braising or roasting or chopping or slicing or dicing, plating food. I mean, all the poaching, even the new sous vide technology that we're using in the kitchen, all those, once you've mastered them, once you've learned them, you're going to be doing them. They're part of the daily routine. They're part of your daily structure. Repetition, in many ways, liberates you to be working on other things. I mean, I've cleaned salmon so many times before that I don't really have to focus on cleaning the salmon. It's almost like muscle memory, and I can be thinking about more other things, like what am I going to do with the salmon when I get it cleaned?
Have you been influenced by any religion that has helped you be more mindful? Because you're talking as somebody who might do yoga or meditation, or even, you know, Judaism is about the present. So there's a lot of religious spiritual components to what you're talking about.
People have said that to me before. Other than as a young boy, I went to Catholic school, and one of the things I did every day was be an altar boy at Mass, and that was something, 7 a.m. Mass, I was there, you know, 5 days a week, or 6 days a week, because then it was also Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really have much, later in life, I didn't have a strong connection to religion, and certainly meditation or any kind of spiritual enlightenment is not part of my... never been part of my life, really. So I'm not sure where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He's the first American chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars for both of his fine dining restaurants, the French Laundry in Napa Valley, California, and Per Se in New York City. You spent your early life in California before moving to Florida. Your parents were divorced. Your father was a Marine drill instructor, and he left your mother when you were 5 or 6 years old with you and your 4 brothers.
Correct.
What influence did your father's absence in your life have on you?
My mother and father didn't have a very good separation, so they didn't part on friendly terms. So, you know, growing up, and I was 4 years old when they separated, so my whole life was with my mother and my brothers. Mm-hmm. My father wasn't really part of it. He was somebody who lived in Pennsylvania. I don't want to say I didn't have any need for him, but I didn't have an apparent need for him. I certainly had those father figures in my older brothers. They were my role models. They were my teachers, you know, from a masculine point of view. And my mother was there. My mother was an amazing person, very dedicated, committed to her children and their well-being. And she ran restaurants, so she was gone in many evenings, which left the older brothers, my older brothers, to kind of cook for us and babysit us, which was fine. But I didn't grow up on, you know, sitting on my mother's knees during the polenta or my grandmother's, you know, in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, baking biscuits. But as I started to grow older, I spent more and more time at the restaurant, and I really enjoyed those moments in my mother's restaurant, in those kitchens.
When you say your mother's restaurant, she was a restaurant manager of an existing restaurant
exactly.
in Florida.
She didn't own the restaurant. She ran the restaurants, yes.
What are some of those early memories that you have with her in the restaurant?
Well, you know, restaurants are very nurturing places. And at the same time, kitchens can be very violent places. Mm-hmm. So you have this real dichotomy between these two environments. You have these individuals in there who are continuously cooking for people and nurturing them. But at the same time, you have sharp knives, you have wet floors, you have steam, you have heat, you have all these different things going on. So you really have to be aware in a kitchen. And I think awareness was key for me. And I think that was one of the great things I learned early on from my mother and being in those kitchens was a sense of awareness of everything that's around me and being careful.
Hmm. When you were with your mother in those earlier years, did you have thoughts of, you know, this is where I want to make my life? When did that come to mature?
I never thought about being a chef in those early days. When I did venture out on my own and have a job in the real world, which was in construction, my older brothers were in construction, so I kind of migrated towards that. But once I found my way back into the kitchen, and although I didn't realize it at that time, looking back at that moment, washing dishes at the Palm Beach Yacht Club really prepared me to be a cook, because the actions that you are doing as a dishwasher, the same things that you're going to be doing as a cook. In other words, it's about organization. So as all the dirty dishes and silverware and glasses come in, you have to be extremely organized. You have to have them stacked correctly. You have to have them piled. You have to have the water ready for the silverware. You have to be efficient. So you have to be able to stack the plates up correctly or get the silverware done correctly so that you're efficient in your movement, so you're not wasting any time. You get instant feedback. You know, if you don't scrape the dishes correctly or spray them down correctly before they go in the dish machine, they come out dirty. Mm-hmm. And then you learn to be part of a team. And everybody in the restaurant relies on you. So those were four critical elements of being a really good dishwasher that you translate to being a really good cook.
Yeah. It was washing dishes that helped you realize, you know what, I can make a life in the kitchen. But you had a level of organization and almost compulsiveness for cleanliness and precision, even outside the kitchen, in your home growing up. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you were like in your own home?
Well, my mother was meticulous. I mean, the house had to be clean all the time. And you take your shoes off before you went inside, you know, I mean, At one point, I remember in my life, the furniture was covered in plastic wrap, you know, to protect the fabric. We all had chores every week. My brothers and I always had chores. And Joseph and I, being the youngest, would always have to do the chores of the oldest. I was the one that always had to clean the bathroom, and that was probably the most difficult and certainly the most... You really became aware of how clean it was.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. We'll hear more from Thomas coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include the French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. You weren't surrounded by, you know, this rich culinary life growing up in any way. How did that transition occur from, you know, washing dishes in a, you know, random restaurant with your mom to actually acquiring this awareness of this whole other culinary world?
So if you think back at the Palm Beach Yacht Club, I was washing dishes. And one day my mother came to me and said, you know, Richard, who was the chef at the time, you know, Richard's going to leave in a couple weeks. So, you know, if you watch what he does, we're going to make you the chef.
How old were you?
I was probably 19.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, this is interesting. But I did have a leg up. My brother Joseph was already in the profession. He had decided at a relatively young age, 12 or 13, that he really wanted to be a chef. And Richard did show me. He showed me how to make an omelet. He showed me how to, you know, grill a flank steak, make hamburgers, things like that. And that's really what basically it was. The most difficult thing I had to do every day was make a hollandaise sauce. And my brother Joseph was very influential in helping me do that.
But no formal training ever.
No formal training. But there was really not an option. There wasn't a lot of options back in 1974 for formal training. Cooking wasn't viewed as it is today. There was really not a whole lot of interest in becoming a chef.
You had the reputation of managing your kitchen as if you were a military marine drill instructor like your father. And it's almost trite to ask, mm-hmm. you know, what parallels are there between you and your father? But how has that occurred to you?
Well, you're right. I mean, absolutely. There is a definite hierarchy in the kitchen. That hierarchy was defined by Augustus Escoffier in the turn of the 1900s.
Is this the brigade system?
The brigade system. Yeah. So you have a brigade or brigade. I mean, brigade in French, brigade in America. And I mean, there is you know, the hierarchy. There's the chef who's the leader. Then there's the sous chefs, demi sous chefs, chef de partie, commis. So you have this real hierarchy of how the kitchen operates. And when you think about a kitchen, especially during service or most of the time, it's about command response. And when you think about it, that initial command really comes from the guest. Mm-hmm. You sit down at the table, you look at the menu, and you choose what you want to eat. And you tell the waiter. And that's your command. Then all of a sudden, as the chef, then you tell all the chef de parties what needs to be done, and they respond. So from a militaristic point of view, it's the same in the military. It's all about command response.
Was it striking to you that, oh, my career is paralleling my father's to a large degree?
It was a little bit. I didn't really think about it until much later in life, my early 20s, when I really started to think about it, and I started to reach out to my father to reconnect with my father at that time in my life.
And when you did reach out to him, you really reconnected in a big way. Your father moved from Pennsylvania to California to be with you at the French Laundry.
Yes.
In Napa Valley. And he died after having a car accident about a year after?
About a year and a half after he arrived in Yountville. He had a horrific car accident that left him a quadriplegic. And that was one of the most challenging moments of my life is to prepare him to come home, his home in Yountville.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He was awarded France's highest culinary decoration, the Légion d'Honneur, for popularizing French cuisine in America in 2011. So you found your home in the French Laundry, and it took you about 2 years to raise $1.5 million to get the restaurant off the ground. Who did you raise the capital from?
Yeah, it was $1.2 million. But I mean, back then that was, you know, I mean, when you don't have any money, you know, a substantial amount of money was an enormous amount of money to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went through three different avenues to raise the money. One was a commercial bank loan, real estate loan. Although I realized that once I started to apply for the bank loans, the failure here in New York City came to be a problem. So I had to have my old partner Serge Raoul, who really went out on a limb for me financially, come back and satisfy some of the debt that was still outstanding at Raquel. Mm. So, you know, when you think about the people that are involved in your life and how they come to your aid in some of the most unpredictable ways, I mean, certainly we had a failed restaurant. We had parted ways. I was gone for 3.5 years, and all of a sudden I need him to come back and satisfy a financial debt for us. And so, you know, that was one of the first individuals that, you know, really stepped up to the plate to help. The second part was a small business administrative loan. And we were very fortunate that I was very fortunate at that time. President Clinton had just come into office. He was trying to re-energize the economy. So he funded the SBA in a significant way. And, you know, a white, middle-class, educated male was not the profile for the SBA prior to that. And then finally, the last component was going out to private individuals for private placement. And I reached out to probably over 400 people. And that was probably the most difficult part of my life, trying to sell this project. And out of 400, we had 50 people who finally signed a check, and that was the final straw that helped me buy the French Laundry.
And the French Laundry in the 1880s, when it was first built, was actually a bar.
Before Prohibition, it was opened as a saloon gambling brothel. Yountville, in that time, we have a veterans home there, which is the oldest veterans home in America, or in California, I'm sorry. And then what happened really is the state really got tired of all the problems they were having in Yountville, so they passed a law that there wasn't a lot of alcohol served within 2 miles of the veterans home. So that shut down Yountville. And that's when a young French couple, bought the property. Yountville, Napa Valley at that time still was a place that many of the social elite from San Francisco would summer in. So their business model was to, you know, service all of these the socialites in their homes with the laundry service. And hence, that was where the French Laundry began.
After 10 years of French Laundry, you opened Per Se in 2004 in New York City. So you returned to the city that rejected you in the earliest days. How did that relationship with the Time Warner Center originate?
Time Warner Center was being developed by the Related Group. At that time, they were really looking towards France to come and occupy and build the restaurants there. At the same time, one or two of the French chefs that just arrived in America received some less than flattering reviews. So they kind of repositioned themselves and said, okay, let's not go to France. Let's look into America. And they reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in being one of their tenants. And I had looked at New York once in a while, you know, mm-hmm. through the history of the French Laundry. You know, people would always say, when are you coming home? You know, home being New York City. If I was going to do another restaurant, another fine dining restaurant, there's really no other city in America to do it. And the Time Warner Center really offered us an opportunity to do it in a significant way.
You had a charmed life with French Laundry, but Per Se had an inauspicious start. There was a fire which mm-hmm. set you back. Can you talk to me about
the
that
fire?
Episode?
We opened the restaurant on February 19th in 2004, a little less than 10 years after we opened the French Laundry. And we had closed the French Laundry and brought 30 of those individuals to Per Se to help inoculate and train the new team. So we were off to a great start. And then on that, the 26th of February, it was right at staff meal. And I was in the butcher room with two of my sous chefs and we were chatting. And we started to smell smoke. Then we started to see smoke. And that's when I evacuated the kitchen, the restaurant. We called the fire department. And that was basically what I thought was the beginning of end. And I stood there when that young fireman, you know, standing on top of the tables and just taking that big axe and going through the wall and the flame shooting out and water pouring out everywhere. And I thought, you know, I called my attorney and I said, I got to get out of here. But the next day we came back and, you know, we had a whole different attitude. We're going to now have a second chance to open this restaurant. And then I started getting cards from our Asian guests, and they were all flowers were coming and congratulations were coming because in Asia, if you have a fire in your kitchen, it means you're going to be successful. So it's just, it was a matter of point of view.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. I want to talk about just the experience of dining in the French Laundry or Per Se. The menus change every day in both restaurants, and you've said that you don't repeat any ingredients in the 9 courses. Is that true?
We repeat luxury ingredients. So there may be truffles twice, or there may be foie gras twice, but we would never have mushrooms twice, or carrots twice, or turnips twice, or things like that.
Do you think the clientele would really mind?
Well, you know, at some point, as much as we appreciate and work for our guests, it's really about us. You know, it's about our values and our standards and challenging ourselves. And it was really a challenge in the beginning. Okay, we're not going to repeat any garnishes, any vegetables. Why would we? We're the French Laundry.
And we're going to have a new menu every day.
Right.
Can you walk me through some of the items on your menus that you are particularly fond of?
Some of the signature dishes or some of the iconic dishes anyway, certainly the coronet of salmon. And what that is, it really looks like a miniature ice cream cone. And the inspiration from that ice cream cone, for that dish came from my experience eating ice cream cones.
At Baskin and Robbins.
Here in Chinatown, exactly. And that's where when you think about awareness, how important awareness is, because you can look at something every day or every week or experience something over and over again and never really realize the full potential of what that is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that day in 1991 when I was at Baskin Robbins and the ice cream cone was put in front of me, did I see the coronet.
How about the oysters and pearls, which is another iconic offering of yours?
Exactly. It's one of those iconic dishes that is prepared every day. It was a purple box. And I was walking down the aisle of a grocery store and I saw a purple box. And on the purple box it said, you know, pearl tapioca. And I'm thinking, where do pearls come from? Pearls come from oysters. And therefore, you know, I bought a box of pearl tapioca, took it back to the French Laundry, and knew exactly what I was going to do with it. And there we have oysters and pearls.
And there is a level of playfulness on the menu at Per Se, mm-hmm. which seems surprising perhaps to people who go because, oh, this is a fine dining establishment and they might expect it to be stuffier than it certainly is.
If you've experienced macaroni and cheese before, I think, which we all have, we can reinterpret that in a way that's going to be significant, and you're going to go, wow, that's just like the best macaroni and cheese I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Coffee and donuts, is another one of those iconic dishes. And when you think about, yes, fine dining restaurants historically have always been intimidating. And it's something that I don't want to represent in our restaurants. And so when you get that cornet, I mean, you have to smile. It's just so darn cute.
The law of diminishing marginal returns is important to you. And the idea is when you are giving people their food, you give them just enough to keep it interesting before they move on to the next.
Exactly. Exactly. And you think about the law of diminishing returns, something that came evident to me when I was a young person living in Florida, and we would go to the beach on Saturday and have beer. That first cold beer on a hot summer day was really amazing, really refreshing, really good. And of course, by the time the second one came around, it was less, and the third one was even less so. And I translated that into the way I thought about food.
There's a comedian, Louis C.K. He says, some people might eat until they're full and then move and then stop, but I eat until I'm ashamed. What are your own eating habits?
I try to eat healthy. Of course, I don't try to eat a lot of food. I try, in the morning, it's very ritualistic. Typically, I'll have, some type of granola with chia seeds and some ground flax seed, which I grind myself. Then I'll have my vitamin regimen with some juice or some probiotics, and then I'll have coffee. And then throughout the day, I typically eat with the team at the restaurant. I'm meeting at 8 a.m. in the morning, at noon, and then again at 4:45, because that's when we serve our p.m. meal. So if I stay on that schedule, I feel really, really good.
I want to talk about your suppliers. You have more than 350 suppliers restaurant?
For the restaurant, yeah. Suppliers come and go depending on the season, depending on what they're growing, depending on where they are.
Can you provide some examples of your suppliers, some of the stories of your suppliers?
There are so many. Ingrid Benjes, who's in Stonington, Maine, who is accidental. I mean, she was an author. She moved to Maine, and she was trying to make a living. And she found some mushrooms and found a home for them at Balducci's here in New York. And they said, well, what else do you have? And she said, well, I'm from Maine. Maybe I can get you lobsters. And so that was almost 40 years ago, Diane St. Clair in Orwell, Vermont. She gets up every day, 7 days a week at 4 a.m. to milk the cows by 6 so that she can start making the butter, that she cultured the day before, make 20 pounds of butter a day.
Incidentally, I have to mention, I was reading New York Magazine recently, and there's this piece on Per Se talking about, that trysts happen. You're working intensely with people, and you become intimate with them. That is true for you, too.
It is.
You hired Laura Cunningham, who was your restaurant manager,
Correct.
Your first hire mm-hmm. at the French Laundry, and she's now your partner.
Exactly.
Can you describe that evolution?
Well, it's in we work so hard and so long, so many hours, you're right. You really become intimate with the individuals that you're working with, in so many ways, and it's always kind of difficult when you begin a personal relationship with a coworker, mm-hmm. but no more so than with Laura and I. Because at the French Laundry, when we were both working at the French Laundry, every day together, we lived next door. It really became a true family kind of environment. I mean, if mother wouldn't let you do something, let's go ask father.
You have this reputation for being really very control oriented, and in fact, you said a kitchen is about control at any level. But do you think you're any different from the top chefs? There's this element of
control.
Yeah.
We're control freaks. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, chefs, historically, I mean, by nature, are control freaks. They want to control. They need to control what's going on in their kitchen so that they're controlling what's going on in the dining room. We talk about emotional chefs, most chefs that have outbursts and, get upset. And where that comes from, I mean, the genesis of that is something happening that prevents me from giving you, the guest, the experience that I want. Because if something comes in the way of that, something clogs that, then there's a problem.
Have you in the past worried, I'm not going to be very well liked if I'm going to be so control oriented? Did you ever have to kind of grapple with that for yourself?
Yeah, you do. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, those emotional outbursts, sometimes became personal, and you realized that that's just not the way to operate. That's not respectful, and you ended up going back to the person that you had that emotional outburst, and you had to apologize to that person.
What's an example? We talk at 30,000 feet of, you know, your attention to detail and your control orientation. What's an example of that in the kitchen day to day?
Everything's about precision.
But what's an example?
Okay, an example is, let's take something as simple as knife skills. You know, cutting brunoise of vegetables. Brunoise of vegetables is something that's 1/8 of an inch square. Mm-hmm. You know, and being able to make sure that the mandolin that you have that slices the elongated piece of vegetable is really, really sharp and has the right calibration in terms of thickness. And then that your knife skills, because then your knife skills come, because then you're slicing that long, thin julienne of vegetable into a brunoise. Let's talk about canneling.
What's
canneling? Canneling is having two spoons. And canneling is something that we do in so many different ways. It's making something in the shape of an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So a canal is something that's the shape of an egg. If you're canneling sorbet or ice cream, you know, it really requires the sorbet or the ice cream to be a specific temperature. And it requires you to have a spoon that's clean and hot so that when you move your spoon through the ice cream or sorbet, the sorbet just folds over itself and forms this perfect egg-shaped canal of ice cream. Or if you're using two spoons, when we're canneling the caviar for the oyster and pearl, for example, making sure that you have enough caviar on the spoon and your spoons are clean and accurate so that, and your movement back and forth to create this shape that you're then going to put on the dish, which is oysters and pearls, which is the first dish that our guests really receive and something that's so impactful for them.
Do you have the same level of precision in your personal life?
Habits are really important. So I think it's important that you recognize a certain standard. And many of us, let's take a T-shirt, for example. You may have a little hole in your T-shirt, and nobody really sees it. So is it to your standard to know that you're wearing a T-shirt that has a hole in it? Or is your standard so that you know there's a hole in it, and it's not acceptable even to you, even though no one else sees it, and you get a new T-shirt?
And what is your standard?
New T-shirt.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been the chef Thomas Keller. Coming up, we'll meet Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, a software company focused on energy efficiency. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, a software company focused on energy efficiency. O-Power works with utilities to monitor how much energy a consumer uses and gives households and businesses incentives to lower their energy consumption. The idea is that through the use of behavioral science techniques such as peer pressure or peer proof, people will feel more compelled to act more responsibly, at least to keep up with their neighbors. Dan started O-Power in 2007 with his Harvard College classmate Alex Lasky. The company is based in Arlington, Virginia. Prior to starting O-Power, Dan launched EduSoft, a software company focused on public school assessments. EduSoft was sold for approximately $40 million to Houghton Mifflin in 2004. Dan is an avid hula hooper. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I heard you like giggle a little bit after hula hooper. Is that true?
I guess I'm a good hula hooper more than an avid hula hooper. It's become a running joke in the company after the first company picnic we had where there was a hula hoop contest that I nearly won but did not win.
Other than hula hooping at your company, can you describe what else you do at O-Power? How does O-Power work?
Well, is there anything else to do other than hula hoop?
You tell me.
Yeah, O-Power is a software company. We work with utilities to help them transform the way they deliver information to their consumers. People just don't really know enough about their energy use, and they're not motivated in the way they could be if they had the right information. And if we could just give them the right info, we could change energy behavior. And so what we do is we use behavioral science techniques, and in doing so, we've shown that we really can substantially reduce consumption consistently and persistently. And on average, we drive about a 2% savings, which for an individual, not much.
What is that, like $40 a year or so?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for a utility, I mean, it's $160 million over our customer base per year.
And why are utilities caring to collaborate with you? Why do they have the incentive to decrease energy use? I know it has something to do with state-level compliance.
That's right.
But can you explain that further?
Legislatures have decided, hey, there's a better way. let's roll, instead of, you know, to meet demand, let's pass a standard that asks our utilities to run programs to help people save energy. And so then the utility puts forward a portfolio of programs, things like light bulb subsidies and O-Power. And then what happens is they put a small tax on the bill. And the only programs they run are ones that actually save you more money than they cost. So the tax is always less than your savings. So the key thing is that utilities, with that tax, they get to recover any of the revenue they would have lost. So they're still made whole. So that way everybody wins.
We're talking about incentives based on behavioral science techniques. What incentives are most powerful for people to reduce their consumption?
The most well-known of the techniques that we employ is the neighbor comparison. It's how we started. So the first product we brought to market was actually a mailed paper report, and we chose the mail because utilities don't have enough customer email addresses. It shows people how their energy use compares to their neighbors and then gives them targeted recommendations on how to save. But the peer proof is a very powerful tool, but it's one of many. Mm-hmm. So as an example, commitment is another very powerful behavioral science technique. Typically, customers who set a goal to save energy save over 8% a year. A third example is just rapid feedback.
You see a lot of this dynamic in other areas such as exercise, right? You give people instant feedback. They're setting their goals. There's the social pressure.
Absolutely.
Where else do you see this?
Well, I think there's a whole trend now of the measured self. All of these different wristwatches that track your heartbeat and change, you know, how many steps you've taken, they're not doing anything to you other than giving you feedback. But what we measure is what we modify. So the behavioral science is more of a tool to grab the customer and engage them about themselves.
How are you using science behavioral techniques in your personal life, for example? Like, with you have a baby, you're married. Do you see yourself like constantly applying these techniques in other ways personally?
I've been accused anxiously in business cases situations of being an expert negotiator because people fear that I have some mastery of the behavioral science sphere. Mm. that I must admit I don't think I have. Mm. But yeah, you can't help but think about these techniques.
In addition to the behavioral science component of the company, you also have a pretty robust data analytics feature. Can you describe that some more?
We can help people understand their usage in very easy, timely, and important to act on ways. As a simple example, we do a predictive high bill forecast. So we've all had that experience where you get that bill in the mail in the middle of winter, and it's $500 or $300, and it blows you away. Now you get a call from us, like a fraud alert. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're 12 days into the month. You look like you're on track for a $300 bill. And what a relief, especially for a low-income customer.
They receive phone calls?
That's right, we do.
Are you the voice for these calls? Because you have that voice, or you're impersonating that voice quite well.
You have received a high bill. No. It's not me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power, and an energy efficiency company that partners with utility companies to reduce energy consumption. The utility companies pay O-Power for its software and receives payments from the government as an incentive to encourage energy reduction. Now, when you first thought of founding this company, did you have this behavioral science in mind, or is it something that you arrived at after coming up with the idea?
Actually, the behavioral science component was one of the original pieces.
And you have a chief scientist. His name is Robert Cialdini. He's a social psychologist. How integral was he in the founding of the company?
Yeah, so the way we got started was we had a simple idea that there were a billion utility bills going out a year to Americans, and there was this huge missed opportunity to educate people about their energy use. But that was, and we knew there was energy efficiency funding out there, but it wasn't enough to start a business. And then we got lucky, and this is where the serendipity came in. We were introduced to the research of Robert Cialdini, who had just the year prior concluded a study with the Hewlett Foundation in San Francisco, or Palo Alto, rather, that showed conclusively that if you gave people information about their energy use relative to the average of similar-sized homes in their area, that they would reduce their consumption.
That, how were you introduced to him? By whom?
I was talking about this with a lot of people, and I was waving my utility bill around at breakfast with this woman, Rhea Sue, who's the Hewlett Foundation. and her eyes went wide, and she said, "You won't believe this. We literally just got a research report on this very fact, you know, 2 weeks ago." And she scanned and sent me the studies. And then we reached out to Bob, and it's been, you know, that's the beginning of the story.
Could you explain the study that he did with the fans?
The study was to try and convince residential homeowners to make a simple, low-cost efficiency move of turning off their air conditioner and switching to a fan in the evening. And they did a door hanger campaign. And they put a door hanger on each door with four different messages. The first message simply said, it was a monetary message, you can save $50 every month if you do this. Second message was about the environment, you can help keep the skies clean for California if you do this. Third message was about preserving resources for the future and being a good citizen. And then they measured those first three against a control group, which received no message. And they saw no impact in consumption, as if they hadn't come. And this is an expensive way to go about marketing. So they had a fourth group that got a message that simply said, in a recent survey of your neighbors, three-quarters of them say they turn off their AC and switch to a fan in the evening. Join your neighbors. With no justification for what the personal benefit was, the economic benefit, the environmental benefit, none of that. Just do what the rest of the folks are doing. And that group saw a 6% reduction in consumption.
Why were you and Alex focused on doing something in the energy arena? You had started a company in education, for example.
So I started an educational software company called EduSoft, and we sold the company, and I had the opportunity to take some time off. And I talked my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, into taking a year-long trip with me. We bought a Toyota 4Runner, we shipped it up to Alaska, and we drove the full Pan American Highway from tip to tip.
So from the Arctic Sea to Patagonia?
That's right.
How did you meet Toby?
We met at a wedding in Birmingham, Alabama.
So here you are on a road trip in Latin America, and what connective tissue is there to O-Power?
So we took this trip. Among other things, we were listening to books on iPod, and we had downloaded Jared Diamond's Collapse, which is really the story of human populations throughout time that have had ecological collapse, ranging from the Mayans to the inhabitants of Easter Island, and you know, how through leadership collapse can be averted, and without it, you can have true catastrophic, you know, ecological degradation. And as we were driving the drive, it felt like I was watching the movie in real time accompanying this book.
What are examples of that?
When we were driving through Guatemala, we were driving across this large plain with cows and bucolic scene. And then we arrived at this outcropping of rock. And on top of this rock, probably a couple acres worth, was the densest rainforest you could think of. And it hit both of us. This huge plain we were driving through had historically been a rainforest. But when you see those things, and you see how stark it is, and you realize how much we have changed the earth, that's when it hits you.
Toby Whitman, you're now wife. You were still boyfriend and girlfriend on your Latin American trip. What is something surprising that she learned about you on that trip, or not on that trip?
She thought I was going to propose when we got to the southern tip, and she hadn't talked to me about that expectation, and so I didn't do that, and that was a shocker. So I made it up to her. What I explained was that I felt odd proposing to her after being a year away from friends and family and feeling disconnected from them, which was just how I felt. I felt like in many ways proposing was more of a public thing than a private thing because I knew I wanted to marry her. Mm-hmm. So to make it up, I went and videoed all of her friends and our families, telling them that I was going to propose to her and asking them what they thought. And then I proposed by showing her this video of basically everyone else knowing before she knew, which was a lot of fun.
So here you are. You and Alex are starting O-Power. You both don't have a background in the energy industry. What were the first things that you did?
As we were just starting this, we were talking to some folks in Texas who told us that we just had to get down there and get involved with what was going on on the legislative side. And there was a bill being introduced around energy efficiency. And we flew out with not even yet incorporated, but with a blow-up, you know, mock-up of our energy report, 2-foot by 3-foot foam core blow-up, marched around with no company, with no brand name, with not even business cards. We managed to meet with all of the key legislators, and we got legislation written into this bill that authorized the utilities to use this public efficiency funding for home energy reports. Now, never mind, there were a few dots that we didn't dot and T's we didn't cross, and we weren't able to use that funding for years to come. But for us, it was this amazing realization that if we could move the needle that far with so little, that there was a real appetite for this.
Yeah, it was incredibly self-actualizing.
Yes. So then we said, okay, let's do this. And that's when we got serious. We raised some money. We incorporated the company, and we went out to and we hired some people, and we went out to go sell utilities.
Do you have a story or an anecdote about your early meetings with some of these utilities?
Well, our first utility that we sold was the City of Sacramento SMUD, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. Allie Crawford, who was a program manager, had funding for a carbon calculator, which was tools to enter in the different parts of your energy use throughout your life and calculate your total carbon footprint. And we showed her what we were doing, and she just was fascinated by it and thought, if you can do my calculator and this, we can work together. And so we went back and in a 10-day period worked nights and weekends and built a carbon calculator.
Were there other utilities or other recollections of meetings with utilities who were not as amenable to what you were doing?
No, I mean, you can't succeed without hearing no 100 times.
Right. So what are examples of some of those?
Most of those are customers of ours now, so I don't have any great examples I want to share.
We talk about getting funding in the early days, and NEA in D.C. was one of your earliest investors, and there's a story of Harry Weller, I think he's a partner at NEA, hearing what you were doing, and he said, utilities give you data and they're paying you? How do we invest?
Yeah, so Harry had a very clear vision, which took me a long time to fully appreciate, that the real power in our business was that we were being put in a position with all of the utilities' energy data to be able to help them on a whole host of consumer-facing issues they had. And that the fact that they were entrusting us with their data put us in a phenomenally strategic place in the landscape. And then that they were paying us for that, as opposed to us begging them for it, was even more astonishing.
I want to talk about your upbringing, your early life. You grew up in San Diego. Your dad was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And your mom was a Hebrew school teacher.
That's right.
What did your dad do in the Air Force?
He was a pilot. He was an instructor pilot with a T-33 jet, and then turboprop. And then he flew C-130s for 10 years, which are those huge cargo planes.
Was he ever in action?
He was. He was in Vietnam. He flew air support in Zaire back when we thought that Mobutu was a good guy to back up, which is, you know, not his proudest day, but he was a good airman. After my dad left the military, he went into defense contracting. He worked for a couple different firms. We ended up moving to San Diego, where he worked at General Dynamics.
We always like to put a bow around like how our childhood influenced what we're doing now. But like what are certain elements of your youth that feature prominently for you?
Yeah, I think for me, if I can draw a line back from O-Power to my youth, it's conservation and computer science. I took a class in 11th grade in AP Pascal and loved it.
AP Pascal being a programming language.
Exactly right. It felt like you were bringing the computer to life. To be clear, I was not a hacker who spent their nights and weekends writing code all the time. But I said this is what I want to do. It's where I want to go and what I want to study in college, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me is I grew up in a family where we would reuse plastic bags and we always turned out the lights and we barely ran the heat and these kinds of things. It established deeply ingrained in me an aesthetic that we shouldn't be wasteful. And my mom grew up in Israel in the 50s, they had nothing, you know. And my dad grew up very poor, so I grew up with parents who had their upbringing in a totally different time and era where they were extremely conservative with things.
After college, you worked at a music startup called Echo Networks.
That's right.
From there, you then started EduSoft, which is this company focused on the public school assessments area. And Jay Kimmelman was your co-founder at EduSoft, and you had known him from Harvard as well.
That's right.
What is he doing now?
Jay Kimmelman has started a network of private, very, very low-cost schools in Kenya. He has, I believe, over 50,000 students now in his schools. And the schools cost less than the public schools. and they have perfect teacher attendance, and they have significantly higher student scores. And he's scaling this now across Africa.
And incidentally, you were raising money for EduSoft in 2000. So even though the story ends well, you had kind of a tumultuous beginning, at least raising money, is my assumption.
It was brutal.
I heard a story that you, when potential investors would visit, you would fill your desks in the office to make it seem like you were busier than you were. Is that
right.
True?
So we had...
Whose idea was that?
It was Jay's, of course. Jay was a magician as a kid. And a vacuum cleaner salesman, and so he had all the great tricks. It was actually the first time Houghton Mifflin came to our offices. We wanted to appear bigger, and we told our friends we would buy them coffee and lunch if they would come and work out of desks in our office from 10 a.m. to noon.
Mm.
And we put phones on the desk and made it all look like we had 12 people at the company when there was only four of us. The problem was... 2 months later, the same guy came back, and we were like, what are we going to do? We got to get the same friends in.
So don't be fooled if you enter the office of O-Power. Some might be paid actors.
I can affirm we have no paid actors.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dan Yates, co-founder of O-Power. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.